Up, Up, and Away, Episode 40, Doomsday is Near. Hello and welcome to Up, Up, and Away, the podcast dedicated to anything and everything Superman. I am your host, Mario Bonessi. So, rumor has it that there's a Golden Age version of the, I guess, Jax Pacific puts these out there, called Big Figs. They're at least 20 inches tall, and they are giant figures. And they have cloth capes, and they look pretty cool. They have a Superman one, and of course you have like 50 million Batman, because Batman. They also have a Flash. Now there's a regular Superman. These are designed after more or less the classic versions of their costumes. So you have the Superman with the bright blue suit, and you have the red shorts, and you have the classic symbol and the yellow S on the back of the cape. And there's apparently a Golden Age version floating around there. They have a couple of them, and I've seen a lot of people post these in the Superman collecting groups that I'm part of. And it's not Action Comics number one Golden Age style. It's more like Fleischer Studios Superman with the S shield with the red S, but the black background on the inside. And then, of course, there's no yellow belt. It's just a yellow circle, and where the belt should be, it's red. That's pretty cool. They're at least $20, which is, I'm gonna eventually try to get both of them. I just need to find them, because like I think I've said in a previous episode, retailers in Boca Raton are terrible at getting new items in, and I highly doubt that they're gonna get these in for a while. But once they do, you can bet your bottom dollar I'm gonna be getting both versions, because I love me some Golden Age and I love me some Superman, hence the show. In other news, my DC Comics Legion of Collectors box came in, and it's alright. The theme was Batman villains. The next box is DC Legacy, so I don't know what that really means. It could be anything from classically designed costumes to giving some recognition to characters that are a little bit more obscure, which would be pretty cool. I've posted an unboxing video on both my personal Facebook, and then I shared that over to the Up, Up, and Away page if you are interested in looking at what's in there. It wasn't too bad of a box. Like I said, it's not my favorite box. I feel like they could have done a little bit better. They really should have tried to incorporate more than just five Batman villains, especially because we got more than five items in the box. Hopefully the next box will be a little bit better. I know a lot of people are really frustrated with Funko, and it's not just for the DC boxes. It's for the Marvel boxes, too. Apparently, the best subscription box that Funko offers is the Star Wars Smuggler's Bounty, which I've seen some pretty good stuff out of there. They usually do at least two pops per box, and I feel like that's something that Funko should be trying to do with both the Marvel Collector Corps and the DC Legion of Collectors, because, like it or not, the pops are the big selling factor on those boxes. People only buy those boxes because of the potential of a really cool pop. Because pop collecting is pretty big. There are pops going for thousands of dollars. Because sometimes they don't make them anymore. They went out of production. They had a limited run, like only 500 pieces made, or 300, I think, is the case for the original Alex from Clockwork Orange. It might be 500, but I know it's a low run number. These things can get pretty pricey. And the pops are the big selling points on these boxes. So I feel like if they were to step up their game on the pops and include two pops for the DC box and the Marvel box, they might fare a little bit better and they might not lose as many subscribers. That, and I think they need to not include the hats and the mugs in the boxes. I prefer t-shirts, just, you know, a personal preference. I get what they were trying to do, and they're trying to expand their line. They have actual mugs that you can buy at, like, your comic book store. I need to get the Superman one because, of course, I need to. But they also have, like, salt and pepper shakers, and they have a set with Batman and the Joker, and then they have a set with Superman and Wonder Woman, and I'm probably going to end up getting the Superman one because why not? But the pops are where they work the best. That's the bread and butter of the Funko company. Not the Dorbs, not the shirts, not the hats, not the salt and pepper shakers or the mugs or the Mopies or whatever else that they have, the Mighty Minis or the Mystery Minis or whatever they're called. their big selling point is the pops, and I feel like maybe they should try to work a little bit more with those. So other than that, there's not really a lot I want to talk about. Nothing really has been happening. We have confirmation from Amy Adams and Henry Cavill that a second Superman movie is coming out as a proper sequel to Man of Steel. Other than that, not too much has been going on. Supergirl's still been pretty awesome. It's just kind of been a slow couple of weeks in terms of Superman news. There have been some things, but just not too much, really, that's, wow, look at this. And even if there were, you can always find out about it at the Superman homepage. Go check it out if you aren't currently not a follower of the website, because they are by far the greatest Superman fan website in the world. So let's go ahead and start covering this week's chapters from The Death of Superman. First up is Superman, Volume 2, Number 74, and this is cover dated December 1992, with executive editor Dick Giordano, cover art by Dan Jurgens and Brett Breeding, written by Dan Jurgens, penciled by Dan Jurgens, inks by Brett Breeding, colors by Glenn Whitmore, letters by John Costanza, and edited by Mike Carlin and Jennifer Frank. We start out right where we left off last issue, except we look at the ground, and we see that Maxima and Ice are overlooking Blue Beetle's body, and Ice thinks that he's going to die, and Maxima says that they need to power on, keep fighting this Doomsday character. Ice is pleading with Maxima. She wants her to use her powers to take Blue Beetle to get some medical treatment while Ice goes and takes care of Doomsday. And Maxima is not entirely down with that. She feels that her powers could best be served fighting this monster. Ice eventually gets Maxima to go take Ted to go get some help. Maxima's reasoning is that Ice had helped her when she needed help, and so she has to return the favor. So Maxima uses her powers, lifts Ted up into the air with some sort of energy field. I'm not entirely sure what Maxima's power set is, and she flies off. Ice goes to take on Doomsday, and she can't find him, so she just follows the path of destruction. And there's one huge problem. Doomsday seems to be heading towards a housing development. Now we cut to the housing development, and we see that Mitch kid from one of the previous issues, the snarky one that said that they should have gotten Guy Gardner on the talk show instead of Superman. And he is exactly the kind of kid that you'd think he is. He's the 90s generic rocker guy with the attitude. His parents are in a bit of a tough situation. They're about to get divorced. His mom's trying to take care of two kids, this Mitch character and her infant daughter. And Mitch, he starts copping an attitude as soon as he walks in the door. And his mom asks him how his day went, and Mitch's giving her all kinds of attitude, saying stuff like you care, and he starts getting on her case because there's no soda in the fridge. His mom starts explaining that she had to take care of the baby because the baby's not been feeling well, and of course Mitch doesn't understand. He's kind of being a jerk about it all, and he says, well, Dad's always got soda whenever I come over. He continues going off, saying that I'm tired of being the only one that rates around here. And his mom tries to make a case for herself. She had things to do. She doesn't have time to go and get soda. She had to take care of the kid. She's a single mom trying to work this house. And Mitch says something very hurtful to his mother, and he says, no wonder Dad left and wants a divorce. And we can see that Mitch does feel bad after he sees that his mother starts crying. He's not a totally heartless jerk. He figures that the only way that he can really fix the situation is if he just goes and cools off for a little bit. So he goes to try and leave for his friend's house when Ice crashes through their window. And then they look outside and they see Doomsday. His hand is still tied behind his back, but he destroys their car. Fortunately, Superman and Booster Gold show up on the scene, and this is Superman's first encounter with Doomsday. Doomsday punches him right in the chest, and it does nothing to Superman. Mitch is still kind of a hothead at this point and says that, oh, it's Superman's own fault. He got punched. He didn't duck. Doomsday figures that he's going to try taking the wind out of Superman's sails. He revs up for a kick and kicks Superman through their house. He flies backwards until he is stopped by hitting a tree in the backyard. Doomsday grabs Booster Gold and slams him into a tree. Now, he's got his force field up, so he's all right. With the two heroes out, Doomsday smashes through the house, and he locates Ice. He punches Ice, and then goes to attack Mitch's mom and her infant daughter. Superman busts through and puts an end to that right quick, and at that moment, the Justice League arrives, minus a couple of members. So you have Booster Gold, Blood Wind, Fire, and Guy Gardner. Superman says that they need to combine their efforts, and they all use their beam powers. Superman, Heat Vision, Guy Gardner, Ring, Booster Gold, whatever technology he has, and Blood Wind and Fire, whatever laser powers they have. Now, they keep shooting and shooting, and it's this giant light show. They can't see anything. Mitch's mom tries to get Ice out of the wreckage of their home, while Mitch carries his baby sister. They're trying to make an escape. At this point, everybody's kind of getting weakened. Fire is the first to faint, followed by Booster Gold's technology being drained. Guy Gardner's ring is no longer got a charge, and, things don't look very good. As the smoke clears, we see that Doomsday is still standing. His containment suit is starting to become even more destroyed. We see half of his face, or at least a good portion of it, and the other hand is freed from behind his back. He then makes a charge for the Justice League. He tosses Superman aside. He's about to trample on Guy Gardner. He uppercuts Fire with his knee, and he grabs Booster Gold by the neck while kicking Bloodwind out of the way. Booster Gold's no longer got any power, and Doomsday is giving it to him pretty good. He punches him, then takes him and slams his head into a tree branch. Then he takes him over to a car and slams the door on his neck. Booster Gold's out like a light at this point. Fire, despite being weakened and not really having much power to fight anymore, goes to help the family get Ice out of the way and get, you know, the entire family to safety. Guy tries to put up a fight, but he can't really see. His eyes are so swollen from taking such a beating that he can't see which direction he's going to fire his ring in. Doomsday is aware of Guy's plan because Guy decides to say his plan out loud, and he throws Booster at Guy. Superman comes up with Bloodwind from behind, and they try to sneak attack him, with Bloodwind attempting to use his eye beams to assault Doomsday. Doomsday hears them coming up behind him, and he punches both of them in their face. Now, unfortunately for our heroes, Bloodwind's eye beams were activated at the time, and they hit a gas line that is connected to the house. The entire house blows up. Fire gets knocked out in the explosion, with Ice still unconscious among the flames. Mitch tries to find his mother, and he hears her crying for help. Doomsday crouches and then makes a tremendous leap. Superman figures that he needs to go after this monster before he can continue his reign of terror. Unfortunately for Mitch and his family, every one of the Leaguers is knocked out cold. His last resort is to suck it up and call for Superman. And he calls, and he calls, and he calls. Superman hears Mitch calling as he chases Doomsday. Doomsday cannot fly. He just leaps tremendous distances in a single bound. He's right on Doomsday's tail, but Mitch's cries continue to eat away at his morality. Does he continue to chase Doomsday, or does he turn around to help this family? And that's the end of the issue. First off, let's look at the cover. I dig this cover so much. It's got a lot of great colors on here. The almost pinkish purple combination that they've got going on in the background looks pretty rad. The Justice League looks like they're not holding up very well. Doomsday looks pretty awesome. Superman just laying the heat vision on. We have Maxima, Booster Gold, and Ice just knocked out. They're out for the count. Booster Gold looks like he's got a little bit of strength left in him. But Bloodwind is not on this cover, which is rather interesting, considering that the entire reason the house blows up is because of his eye beams. Going into the actual issue itself, a lot of this is par for the course. Maxima looks really good. The way that Dan Jurgens draws her hair flowing in the wind, it's magnificent. Even the faraway shots look fantastic. There's a lot of detail with the wreckage. I made a joke about this in the previous episode, but there was a bit of dialogue that I think I had forgotten, but I kind of remembered, that kind of justified the Guns N' Roses listening type comment that I had made, where he walks in and his mom asks, "Mitch, dear, is that you?" And he says, "No, it's Axl Rose and the band." Of course, if you know rock and roll, or you know the band Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose is the front man of Guns N' Roses. The page where Mitch says that comment to his mom about, "This is why Dad is leaving," there's a lot of emotion. You see the anger and frustration in his face. You see the defensiveness in his mother. And then you see her break a little bit. And you see the remorse in his face. There's this great mirrored panel where there's two panels. One panel is Mitch, and he looks regretful that he said these things to his mom. And you see the brokenness of his mom, because she's really just trying to keep the family together. She's trying to keep the house running. She's trying to make things somewhat normal, despite a really crappy situation. Doomsday just looks menacing. The panel where Doomsday punches Superman, that's pretty cool. Superman, he's got his chest puffed out. He's got a steely look of determinism on his face, and he's just not having any of it. Of course, the panel where Superman is kicked by Doomsday for the first time, Doomsday is a force to be reckoned with. There's a panel where Doomsday busts into the house, and a lot of him, aside from the fist and the eyes, are shadows, and it's pretty terrifying. While I was reading this, I tried to put myself into the position of the family. How would I feel if all of a sudden this monster that managed to put Superman through a house and take down the Justice League just busted through my house? I would be terrified. I like the use of colors in the section where the Justice Leaguers use their beam powers to fire at Doomsday. A lot of purples, a lot of the same color, pinkish purple that we get on the cover. Very interesting looking. And then the one page splash with Doomsday just taking on all of the Leaguers. That's pretty rad. There's really not that much else to say about this issue. Again, colors work really well, especially in the bits where the entire house is engulfed in flames. For some reason, and I don't know why, and it doesn't bother me too much. It's just kind of weird. Superman has these really dark shadows under his eyes. It's really weird. It's really shadowy, and it's not just in one panel, and it's a lot of panels. It's not too distracting, I guess, is just kind of an interesting artistic choice. So let's move on to the next issue, and that is Adventures of Superman number 497. It's cover dated December 1992. Executive editor is Dick Giordano. Cover art by Tom Grummett. Written by Jerry Ordway. Pencils by Tom Grummett. Inks by Doug Hazelwood. Colors by Glenn Whitmore. Letters by Albert DeGuzman. And edited by Mike Carlin and Jennifer Frank. We continue where we left off. Superman is still pursuing Doomsday. The League is still out. And Mitch is still calling for help. Superman catches up to Doomsday and gives him a mighty, mighty punch. Back at the house, Mitch is trying to find a way to get his mom. She's trapped inside the house under a lot of rubble, or at least a lot of rubble and debris has kept him out and unable to rescue her. He's continuing to yell for Superman, despite the smoke kind of making it really hard on him to talk. Booster Gold regains consciousness. Fire's still out. Ice regains consciousness a little bit, but her ribs are broken pretty badly. Guy's still out, and Mitch is still screaming. Superman turns around for half a second, and Doomsday takes advantage of this opportunity and decks Superman. Superman grabs him by the throat and then drags him down to the bottom of a lake, and Superman figures that if he can keep Doomsday distracted long enough, then he can go and save Mitch and his family, and then continue to take Doomsday on. The debris is starting to crumble around Mitch's mother, and before it can actually come down on them, Bloodwind rushes in at the nick of time and keeps the structure from falling on them. Superman comes in and swoops Mitch's mom and her infant daughter out of the fire and brings them to the ambulance. A lot of the Leaguers are put on stretchers, including Guy Gardner, Fire, and Booster Gold. Bloodwind, however, refuses to seek medical care and vanishes before any further questions can be asked. Guy tells Superman to put this Doomsday guy in a pine box or he's going to come after him, and Superman continues off after Doomsday. Free from the mud, Doomsday jumps out of the lake and attacks a military-grade helicopter. He smashes it to bits. They were about to fire missiles, but they've gone haywire, and now they are flying everywhere. Superman grabs a missile, throws it at Doomsday, and then proceeds to save the two pilots. Word of Doomsday's path of destruction reaches a town in Kirby County, which is a nice little nod to Jack Kirby. Two members of the police force hear an interesting sound before something crashes on top of one of the police cars. It's Doomsday, and then they hear that sound again. It's Superman. Superman lands, hitting Doomsday feet first. Of course, the streets are a little bit worse for wear at this point. Superman is grabbed by Doomsday, and the two engage in battle. The police chief calls for the National Guard and tries to tell them that, hey, we're not joking around here. This is pretty serious. We got Superman and this monster, and they're tearing up our town. We need some help ASAP. Doomsday is thrown through a wall, and military helicopters arrive on the scene. They start shooting at him, but if it's having no effect, Doomsday grabs a street lamp and uses it to spear the helicopter. Doomsday throws the helicopter, and right before it makes impact with Town Hall, Superman grabs the two pilots, but the Town Hall is probably not going to be in use for quite a while. Doomsday's laughing it up when all of a sudden Maxima shows up and gives him a swift uppercut. At the WGBS building, Lois Lane is trying to get into a recording room, but the security guard is not going to let her in. They're in the middle of recording a Turtle Boy episode for a TV series called The Brave and the Bold, which is two really cool references. Cat Grant walks into the scene, and she says that she can give Lois Lane clearance. Lois is trying to get a hold of Jimmy because Perry is demanding to get photographs of this Doomsday business. Lois, Jimmy, and Cat Grant all leave before tuning into a newscast with Steve Lombard reporting that 30 have been left dead in this Doomsday scenario with hundreds injured, and it appears that Doomsday is on a straight path crossing from Ohio through New York State, and it's possible that he may stop at or make his way through Metropolis. At Lex Towers, Lex Luthor II, which is really just a clone version of Lex Luthor, with the brain of the original Lex Luthor in its body, is sitting with Supergirl, which is the Matrix Supergirl at this point in continuity. Supergirl wants to go and help, and Lex says that he needs her to stay here. The people of Metropolis are probably going to get scared, and probably nice to have somebody in their corner because Superman's already taking care of Doomsday, and just in case. Back in that little town, Doomsday and Maxima prepare to showdown. Maxima throws Doomsday through a little convenience store, and Superman gets on Maxima's case because she really should have checked if there were people in that building. Understandable. Maxima tries to punch Superman, but Superman catches the punch. They need to stop fighting, and they need to start working together. Doomsday comes through and hits both of them. Superman grabs Doomsday around the neck and tries to hold him off and tells Maxima to punch. As Maxima goes to punch, Doomsday ducks, and she ends up hitting Superman, flinging him back. Doomsday then punches Maxima over to a gas station and then hits her over the head with a van. Maxima's furious now, and Superman again dives and hits Doomsday with his feet. But they're in a pretty bad location for Superman to be doing that kind of stuff. They end up destroying a gas pump, and gasoline starts spurting everywhere. Maxima takes a light post, but right before Superman tells her, no, that's a really stupid idea because of the sparks, the entire gas station explodes. Maxima and Superman are down for the count as Doomsday continues on his path of destruction. Guardian shows up onto the scene and gives Superman a hand. He's pretty strong. He can take this. Maxima, though, she's a little worse for wear. And Superman says that he needs to go and take on Doomsday alone. And that's the end of the issue. Really, really cool. A lot of action. And it's just a lot of action from this point on, folks. The cover, I absolutely adore this cover. It's Superman headbutting Doomsday right in the stomach with a lot of oranges in the background. And it is phenomenal. I absolutely love this. Of course, we get some really interesting splash pages or giant panels with Superman beating up Doomsday. And the panel where Superman drags Doomsday down to the bottom of the lake and then swims upward. The way that the cape is drawn is fantastic. I love it. The panel where Superman goes and rescues the family before the house can collapse on them is also really great. I like Superman saving people from burning buildings. There's always just something inherently cool about that. Of course, Superman grabbing the missile. Oh, I also should have mentioned that Superman goes after the other missiles that went haywire. He doesn't just catch the one and call it at that. But the panel where Superman catches the missile and throws it at Doomsday, that's cool. Just Superman throwing missiles is also really cool. The panel where Maxima just uppercuts Doomsday, there's a lot. You can feel the power of the punch. It's just giant kapow and bright pink letters. Of course, we have a lot of cool references. We have Kirby County, which is a nice reference to Jack Kirby, who did a lot of work for the Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen title, was the creator of the Fourth World stuff, so Orion and High Father, Darkseid, Apocalypse, Mother Boxes, all that stuff, the Black Racer, a lot of cool concepts that Jack Kirby brought into the DC universe. And of course, we have the Turtle Boy, which is Jimmy playing the Turtle Boy for a kids' TV program, which is pretty neat. And I have covered the issue where Jimmy does turn into the giant Turtle Man, or Turtle Boy, or whichever you want to call it. And then the little reference, the Brave and the Bold TV show, the Brave and the Bold was the Batman equivalent of the DC Comics Presents thing, and it was where Batman would team up with certain people. At least it evolved into that, which is pretty cool. Neat little reference. There are a lot of little references and winks and nods in this era of DC Comics, and there still are today. The panel where the gas station explodes, it's this almost Garfield-looking color of orange, I guess. I hope that's the right way to describe the orange, but it's powerful. Silhouettes, and then there's this giant lettering, and it's kind of wavy, and it says, Kaboom! And the only other color, aside from the white, black, and the yellow, from the word sound, the color of the explosion, the little bits of fire at the bottom, which is a very light yellow, and then the silhouettes of the three characters, which is Maxima, Doomsday, and Superman, the only other color, Superman's symbol, is just red. You can see just the red bits on the Superman symbol. I always think that's cool. I don't know why it's cool, but I always think it's cool. And of course, we have Guardian coming in at the end of this issue, and I love Guardian. He's a really cool character. And we're going to see a little bit more of him in the coming issue. The next issue is Action Comics number 684, and it's got a cover date of December 1992. Executive editor Dick Giordano, cover art by Art Thibbert. I hope I said that right. Written by Roger Stern, pencils by Jackson Geiss, inked by Dennis Rodier, colors by Glenn Whitmore, letters by Bill Oakley, and edited by Mike Carlin. At this point, I want to note that beginning last issue, we started with the countdown in the panels. So on each page, there would be exactly four panels. Now, they could be of any size or shape that they wanted to be, but there were always going to be four panels per page. Now we're at the three-panel mark, and as the story gets closer and closer to the death, it goes to a countdown. So it's four last issue, three this issue, next issue is two, Superman 75 is just one. And I think it's really interesting, and it's a great way to build the tension. So we continue where the story left off. Superman's about to go take on Doomsday. Guardian's taking care of Maxima. So Superman flies off, and he, from overhead, he can see this giant path of destruction. He's not even stopping. He just keeps going. He's like a tornado. So we cut over to Doomsday, and we see he's just destroying this overpass. One or two punches, completely destroyed. A car is about to come up on him, and, Doomsday, instead of completely destroying the car, just throws it up into the air. Suddenly, Doomsday's attention is caught by something. Now, we follow this car, and this guy in the car, he thinks he's dreaming. Starts to think that, oh, well, this is great. I should probably just wake up, though, because I've fallen asleep at the wheel. And then his car starts to fall in reverse. This is no dream. Before his car can fall too far, Superman grabs his car and makes sure that he's alright, before asking him, hey, where'd Doomsday go? The man in the car gives Superman a heads up to the destroyed overpass, and he says that, alright, well, I'm going to put you down on the ground. Make sure that when you get down there, tell the state trooper that they're going to need some backup, and especially send some to the shopping plaza on the northwest side of Midvale. Also a nice little reference. At this shopping center is a LexMart. This is obviously owned by Lex Luthor, and Doomsday is tearing it up. People are running in fear, and there's a message coming over the intercom that says, attention LexMart shoppers, this is an emergency situation. Please exit the store in a calm and orderly fashion. Doomsday is just going on a rampage, and then he hears this voice.
Hey, you. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Come closer. You don't want to miss a single moment of the greatest spectacle in the history of professional wrestling. I'm talking tag teams, I'm talking steel cages, I'm talking knockdown, drag-out, grudge matches. I'm talking about War Bash 9000 this weekend at the Metropolis Arena. I'm Major Mayhem, troopers, and I'm out for blood. I'm taking on the mighty gorilla, Ugly Ben Studley, and the masked bone crusher, and I will prevail. This time, it's war. Pro wrestling as you've never seen it before. This weekend at Metropolis Arena. Metropolis Arena, Metropolis Arena. Now where are you gonna go?
It's a television ad, and Doomsday starts catching on. He starts sounding out the word Metropolis. Superman comes in and decks Doomsday with a mighty punch. He then punches Doomsday through a loading dock, and everybody there is like, hey, we gotta get out of here. Let's scram. Superman starts to notice that as Doomsday and him continue to fight, he seems to be getting a little bit more powerful. Does this guy have backup energy reserves? And if he does, could they rival his? Because we all know Superman can take a punch. We know he can take a beating. But this is unlike anything that he's seen before. Two helicopters show up, and one of them is the Daily Planet's flying newsroom. Lois and Jimmy are in that helicopter. Jimmy's taking pictures, and Lois is recording a rough draft of an article that's going to be going to the Daily Planet. Either that, or she's just writing this off the top of her head and just having them type it up as they go along. Back at LexCorp Powers, Supergirl tells Lex that, hey, we probably need to start interfering here. They're tearing up a LexMart. It's getting closer to Metropolis. Lex doesn't want her to go because she had gone off during the Blaze Satanus War, and he isn't really cool with her going and leaving again. Lex says that, hey, Superman's gonna be okay, and then he thinks to himself, as if Superman really needs help. He's always survived despite my best laid plans. Back with Superman and Doomsday in a Big Belly Burger parking lot, Doomsday picks up a bus and throws it at Superman. Superman is thrown through a restaurant, and he's not doing too well. Doomsday goes to attack Superman when he sees a Metropolis, where he sees a sign that says Metropolis, 60 miles. And he starts saying, Metropolis, Metropolis Warbash. Superman figures that, oh, crap. He's starting to put two and two together. He's starting to make a connection. I gotta draw the line right here. He is not getting into Metropolis, and he decks him with a mighty, mighty punch. I say that a lot, but you can feel the power of this punch. Jimmy notices that Superman must have gotten a second wind because he's never seen Superman fight this hard. Superman grabs Doomsday by the leg, spins him around, and then throws him all the way into the mountains. Superman flies off to go meet Doomsday. And Lois says that, hey, we need to turn this copter around. We need to go cover this story. Of course, the helicopter driver says, hey, they're going pretty fast. I can't keep up with them. Lois says, just go as fast as you can. Come on, we gotta get this going. And they land. We cut inside to see some officials from Project Cadmus. They hear this giant explosion, and they wonder, hey, what's that explosion? Oh, crap, maybe it's got something to do with that Doomsday thing. I don't know, and it's kind of a shame, because our guy, Guardian, he's not here. Let's hope everything's all right, so let's give him a call. Doomsday and Superman start to emerge from the rubble. Superman goes, and he decks him again. They're punching through this giant area of hollowed trees, and the area is called Habitat, and it's a tree city grown by creations of the Cadmus Project. Guardian gets a message over in that little town from his little motorcycle from his boss, and he says, hey, you need to get back to base at once. And they kind of fill him in. Back at Habitat, Superman and Doomsday still duking it out, and Superman figures, hey, wait, maybe this is a Project Cadmus thing. For a second, I thought it might have been something that Lex might have been up to, but Cadmus has been up to some pretty sketchy dealings lately. Fortunately, this is an uninhabited area. Superman takes a giant tree and just hits Doomsday with it. Now, of course, Habitat starts to crumble because it's only trees, and these two are colossal forces that are clashing. Superman is knocked out for a little bit, but Guardian shows up. Doomsday is beneath the rubble. Right as they think everything's all right, Doomsday bursts out of the rubble and knocks them to the ground. They are now pretty much beneath the rubble. Doomsday regains his bearings and jumps towards Metropolis. One of the officials at Project Cadmus starts trying to get a hold of Guardian, not having any luck. He's knocked out. The official then tries to get a hold of security and says, hey, we need to go warn Metropolis right now. Send a message to them that this creature is on his way. And we see this great three panels. We see the sign that says Metropolis, 50 miles. And then it's trampled by Doomsday. And then the final panel shows a destroyed Metropolis sign and Doomsday heading right to the heart of the city. Doomsday is coming. And that's the end of the issue. I like this cover, though it's probably not one of my favorite covers from the story. Just like Justice League America number 69, The last issue that we had covered, The Adventures of Superman number 497, I really like that cover a lot. This one's really good, and I really do like Jackson Geiss's artwork. I think he does a really good job. I really dig his work on the post-crisis Flash stuff. He did some really great work on there. There are some really great moments where Superman just looks strong. Doomsday looks terrifying again. There's not much to really be said that I probably won't say, you know, coming up, or I haven't said already. This is just a lot of bombastic action. Of course, you got the over-the-top 90s wrestling commercial. The page where Superman punches Doomsday right when he sees the Metropolis 60 miles sign, that's also really good. It kind of reminded me of a Bronze Age rendering of Superman for some reason. You can just feel, and I mentioned this before, you can just feel the tension and the drama building as the number of panels is reduced. And I think that was a really cool artistic choice to go with. It just looks really cool. Of course, we get to see more Guardian. He doesn't play too heavily into the issue. He comes in just to make sure that everything's all right and then give Superman a helping hand. The last three panels, though, and I mentioned this before, look awesome. Because we don't really focus too much on Doomsday. A lot of the stuff that's in the panels is the message from the Cadmus official saying that they need to warn Metropolis. Really cool. So we have two issues left of this story, and then we'll take it from there. So let's move into this episode's Adventures of Superman. This episode's Adventures of Superman is entitled Tsar of the Underworld, and its original broadcast date was February 13th, 1953. It was written by Eugene Salo and directed by Tommy Carr, and of course, this review is written by James Lance over at the Superman homepage. It stars George Reeves as Superman / Clark Kent, Jack Larson as Jimmy Olsen, John Hamilton as Perry White, Robert Shane as Inspector Henderson, Anthony Caruso as Luigi Dinelli, Paul Fix as Ollie, John Maxwell as the studio police officer / Frank Dinelli, Roy Gordon as Tommy, Stephen Carr as, and I kid you not, Director Carr, Joe Kirk as the gangster with the binoculars, and Sidney Clute as Shorty. Clark Kent's articles in the Daily Planet exposing crime boss Luigi Dinelli are being made into a movie entitled Tsar of the Underworld, produced by National Studios in Hollywood, California. Metropolis Police Inspector Bill Henderson and Kent himself will serve as advisors during the filming. While Henderson is in Kent's office waiting for the mild-mannered reporter to prepare to leave for their airplane flight, Dinelli calls. However, this is merely to distract Clark while a hitman finally tries to shoot him after being unable to see the target with a jammed gun. The bullet misses, but it makes both Clark and Henderson more determined to get Tsar of the Underworld made, no matter how risky it is for them. Clark and Henderson have arrived in Hollywood. They just may not get to National Studios. Two of Dinelli's men have knocked out the driver that is to meet them, and one is following in another car while the other drives Kent and Henderson to a place where they can be dealt with. The automobile is locked in a dark garage as Clark changes into Superman. The Man of Steel knocks the thugs' heads together, leaving them for the police. Now resuming his reporter's guise, our hero and Henderson make their way to National Studios to be certain that Tsar of the Underworld can put Luigi Dinelli behind bars forever. Luigi Dinelli's war with National Studios is heating up. Film is burned and property is damaged. To make matters worse, actor Alan Dexter was shot dead on the set. A live bullet was mixed in with the blanks normally fired from guns during filming. Word of the murder has reached Daily Planet editor Perry White thanks to a teletyped news flash given to him by Cub reporter Jimmy Olsen. White is angry that Clark didn't give him a first-hand account of the events at National Studios. However, Kent has his hands full, and he'll need all the strength at his disposal to stop Luigi Dinelli and his gang as Superman. Henderson and Clark have met with the studio police chief and have examined Alan Dexter's trailer on Stage 13. The peculiar thing is that Kent wants to spend the night there while Henderson is in the complimentary suite in the Mark Stevens Hotel. With Henderson there, Clark is more free to confront Dinelli's mob as Superman. Meanwhile, Dinelli himself has learned of Clark's sleeping at National Studios. The crime boss intends to eliminate the mild-mannered reporter with the aid of the same person he has working inside the motion picture production company. Superman definitely has his work cut out for him with this adventure. The studio police chief has let Clark look at the Los Angeles Police Department's file on Dinelli. Now Superman knows where to find the gang lord. He knocks out Dinelli's henchmen before doing the same to Dinelli himself. The Man of Tomorrow then flies with Dinelli to the National Studios. According to what Superman tells Inspector Henderson, he'd rather have Dinelli in Dexter's trailer in Clark's place should the killer show up on Stage 13 tonight. With Henderson following, the last son of Krypton goes to National Studios. Their objective is to bring down Luigi Dinelli's crime empire forever. A man whose face is hidden by a hat and trench coat has entered Studio 13. He has attached a hose to a car's tailpipe and Alan Dexter's trailer. The engine has started, causing carbon monoxide to enter the small living quarters. Superman and Henderson arrive in time to shut off the automobile. The unconscious Dinelli is safe, but the person who had thought to murder Clark Kent is still on the loose. A bullet has just missed Inspector Henderson. Now Superman is pursuing the person who had fired the gun. In his panic, the killer falls from the rafters. The man is then revealed to be the studio police chief, who tells Henderson that he is in reality Frank Dinelli, Luigi's brother. Frank had had plastic surgery done to hide his face and had assumed the role of studio police chief to be his brother's inside man. It was Frank who Luigi had ordered to put live ammunition in the gun that killed Alan Dexter. However, before Frank can talk further, Luigi regains consciousness and shoots him to death. Now crime boss Luigi Dinelli is in handcuffs and will not be able to get himself out of trouble. Superman and Inspector Henderson will make sure he remains in prison for life. Kent would get a big kick out of this, Inspector Henderson says, the czar of the underworld and bracelets. Too bad he isn't here. Oh, he's here, in a way, Superman replies wryly. I really dig this episode a lot. Mainly because, you know, film major, you know, it makes sense for me to really dig Superman doing stuff with film. It also made me really sad when the mobsters burned the film, but, you know, it did make me sad. There are a lot of great comedy bits in this, surprisingly. The bit where Inspector Henderson talks to Perry White on the phone, and Perry White's just going on, oh, why didn't Kent call me first? Now I have to compete with all these other newspapers, and I got a teletype of, you know, he's being a bad reporter. He's not letting his editor-in-chief know these things. And Inspector Henderson just kind of slowly puts the phone down and backs away. Really funny stuff. The moment where Superman goes to meet with Inspector Henderson, and Inspector Henderson is just eating his steak, and Superman says, hey, it's probably time to go take care of this Dinelli business, if I can pry you away from your dinner for a second. And Inspector Henderson says, oh, I've already finished my dinner. I'm eating Kent's. Really funny stuff. I've said it before, and I said it again. I love Robert Shane as Inspector Henderson. He brings something special to the cast, and it's always a pleasure seeing him on screen. I think he's a great character, and I wish that they would actually bring him into the mainline comic books. There are a lot of great action moments in here. We got to see a lot of cool Superman stuff. We see him diving feet first through a window. He breaks the window, like the actual glass. Like he breaks through the glass to stop Dinelli, or to capture Dinelli. That's cool. We get to see him do all kinds of fighting and stuff with the criminals, and Superman is doing his thing, and I love it, and I'm always going to love Superman going up against gangsters, because I love Superman going up against gangsters. There's just something cool about it, man. I dig this one. Watch it. Absolutely watch it. I highly recommend it. It's probably one of the best episodes of the first season. So I've made a conscious decision to, despite my throat being a little bit sore from all the talking that I've been doing, my USB port for some reason is starting to work again. I don't know why it's doing that, but I'm not complaining. I guess it might be because I restarted my computer and that might have been the problem. But I'm going to attempt to finish the A's for the Essential Superman Encyclopedia. So let's begin. The Atomic Skull. Dr. Albert Michaels, a disgruntled Star Labs employee who suffered from a rare neurological disease, was the first Atomic Skull appearing on the pre-First Crisis Earth 1. Rogue medical doctors corrected the malfunctioning of the neurotransmitters and receptors in his brain with cybernetic implants, but Michael soon discovered that the malfunctioning microcircuitry gave him the power to convert his brain's electrical impulses into massively destructive bursts of energy that he could direct with pinpoint accuracy. He took his name from Skull, the crime organization with which he had become entangled, and that's in Superman Volume 1, Number 303, September 1976, as Michaels, and Superman Volume 1, Number 323, May 1978. Michaels was widely believed to have perished in the Earth-reshaping cataclysm of the First Crisis, although there was one reported sighting thereafter. In any event, there was no known connection between him and the second Atomic Skull, Metropolis University film student Joe Martin. Suffering a variety of symptoms that his regular doctors couldn't explain, Martin turned to Star Labs, whose scientists were able to tell him that he possessed a dormant metagene. Martin's symptoms began to appear during the event known as Armageddon 2001, and the Star Building was under attack from Monarch at the exact time Joe was hearing the diagnosis. Martin escaped the building's destruction, but not before the stress of the experience triggered the gene's activation. Martin awoke the next morning to find himself bald, glowing in the dark, and seemingly possessed of super strength. Then, on his way back to Star for help, he suffered severe head trauma and an altercation with some gang members trying to steal his bike. That's in Action Comics number 670, October 1991. By the time Superman caught up with him, his flesh had turned transparent, which, coupled with the radiation he was emitting, made him look as if he had a flaming skull for a head. When Superman attempted to stop his destructive rampage, which began after Martin stole a motorcycle and dubbed it his skull bike, it quickly became clear that the student had grown delusional. Martin seemed to believe he was the hero of a favorite old movie serial, The Atomic Skull. And Superman, it seemed, appeared to Martin as the Atomic Skull's archenemy, Dr. Electron. While Superman attempted to capture him, reporter Lois Lane arrived on the scene to get the story and immediately found herself abducted by Martin, who believed her to be the heroine of the serial. The Man of Steel was able to subdue the skull only by wrapping his head in a dampening rod from Star's nuclear reactor, absorbing enough radioactivity to allow Superman to knock him out. It's in Superman, The Man of Steel number 5, November 1991. Thereafter, Martin occasionally relapsed into his atomic skull psychosis despite ongoing treatment. Joe actually had one sustained period of recovery that allowed him to write a book on his experiences. It's in The Adventures of Superman number 571, October 1999, but has continued to have increasingly violent relapses. That's in Manhunter volume 4, number 31, August 2008. The Atom Master, a bald, bespectacled scientist who briefly terrorized Metropolis and Gotham City with elaborate illusions created by a thought projection helmet. The illusions were in the service of a series of robberies through which he hoped to bankroll a more elaborate device that could create solid, vastly more threatening images, altering the atoms in the dust to create illusions and then materialize them. Before the plan could come to fruition, Batman deduced the location of the criminal and Superman raced in at super speed, rendering the man he dubbed the Atom Master unconscious, vowing that he'd wake up in jail. That's in World's Finest Comics number 101, May 1959. Years later, the Atom Master returned to finally use his new tech, built into a more form-fitting helmet, as a member of the Forgotten Villains. That's in DC Comics Presents number 77, January 1978, number 78, February 1985, as well as Resurrection Man number 25, June 1999. The Auctioneer, an alien criminal whose powers and capabilities were functions of advanced technology rather than genetic anomaly. He was an intergalactic importer who, not unlike the pre-First Crisis incarnation of Brainiac, effortlessly amassed all objects or creatures that struck his fancy anywhere in the universe. He then sold his collection at auction. As he did in his first documented appearance, the Auctioneer would dispatch his robotic collectors to uproot significant landmarks while remaining concealed aboard a spacecraft. It was from that spacefaring headquarters that the Auctioneer would accept bids on his catalog, and there that Superman tracked him. But as one of the few surviving Kryptonians, the Man of Steel inadvertently became the Auctioneer's most valuable collectible of all. Adding many other metahumans to the captivities aboard his ship, the Auctioneer effortlessly formed a coalition of superheroes and their super enemies. At first believing their powers to have been stripped, members of the Uneasy Alliance soon deduced that their powerlessness was only a self-delusion, induced by tech that affected them psychologically. Overcoming their mental block, the united antagonists neutralized the Auctioneer's powers by disabling his hardware and threatened to make his incapacity permanent unless he agreed to leave Earth. The Auctioneer complied and departed, but not without indicating his desire to do business with Earth's metahumans sometime in the future. That's in Action Comics number 841, September 2006. Aura, an Asian-American metahuman who was a comrade of the clone Superboy Kal-El and a team that called itself the Ravers. Her real name was Lindsay Waugh, and she adopted the Aura persona after manifesting the ability to manipulate polarity, meaning she could control virtually anything magnetic, even resisting the gravitational fields of planetary surfaces, enabling her to fly. Always a colorful, somewhat flamboyant figure, she used her magnetic abilities to build the suits of armor she wore against her opponents. That's in Superboy and the Ravers numbers 1 through 19, September 1996 through March 1998. Wa was clearly an emotionally troubled young woman with a brittle, edgy personality, sometimes characterized even by her teammates as having a mean, almost vicious streak. This quality made her a formidable opponent and teammate the other Ravers could rely on in battle, but she could be difficult to work with. Small wonder considering her wildly dysfunctional family and tragic history. She joined the Ravers to escape the haunting memory of having allowed her wealthy father, a Hong Kong businessman with a dubious reputation, to frame her for his murder of her mother, who is also a metahuman, an act motivated by his hatred of metas. That's in Superboy and the Ravers number 17, January 1998. In clearing her own name in the present, Wa forced a confession from her father and brought him to justice, but the conflicting emotions aroused by having betrayed her father in order to serve justice weighed heavily on her forever after. That's in Superboy and the Ravers number 16, December 1997. When last seen, Aura had nearly been killed by Dr. Polaris, a.k.a. Repulse. That's in Action Comics number 827, August 2005. Auron, a superhero who was actually a clone of another, earlier metahuman. After the Man of Steel was murdered by Doomsday in pre-Infinite Crisis Metropolis, then-director of Project Cadmus Paul Westfield stole the Man of Steel's body in an attempt to map his Kryptonian genomes. After the closest possible approximation of Superman's genetic code was developed and saved to a computer disk, Westfield conspired to confiscate it from the Cadmus personnel responsible for its security, forcibly if necessary. To that end, Westfield created a clone of Jim Harper, that's the Guardian, which he named Auron. The project director outfitted Auron in indestructible solar-powered armor and a digitized jetpack cybernetically plugged into his brain. Auron succeeded in wrestling the disk from the other clones, who included the young Newsboy Legion, their adult fathers, and Dublex, almost killing them in the process. But his interaction with them triggered his replicated, buried memories of having been the Guardian. Thus reminded of his true allegiances, Auron was persuaded to take the only copy of the DNA into space with him, rather than surrendering it to Westfield. That's in Legacy of Superman number 1, March 1993. Later, the resurrected Superman encountered Auron in space and enlisted his help against the Super Criminal Massacre. Auron was subsequently killed and buried by Superman on a distant planet. There have been no reported appearances of Auron since The Adventures of Superman number 509, February 1994. Axelrod, Carey, the Daily Planet photographer who famously ran afoul of Lex Luthor's mania for secrecy regarding his private life. Prone to dressing in black, the platinum blonde Axelrod, that's in Adventures of Superman number 554, January 1998, saw her 15 minutes of fame begin when she sneaked into LexCorp and took the first photographs of Lex Luthor's newborn daughter, Lena Luthor. That's in Action Comics number 742, March 1998. After buying the Daily Planet, Luthor took particular satisfaction in firing Axelrod and advising her that she would thereafter be unemployable in Metropolis. That's in Superman Save the Planet one-shot, October 1998. We've done it. We're finally through the A. So we have 25 letters more, and this is a very, very long book with very, very long entries, but I'm enjoying this because there's a lot of great information in here. And speaking of lesser-known information, it's time for the super fact and the super quote. For the super fact, did you know that for the longest time, Superman's heat vision was actually just a byproduct of his X-ray vision? See, his X-ray vision would just emit a large amount of heat, and he would just use that as, well, as a way to melt things. And they eventually just split it up into two powers. And for this episode's super quote, it comes from 2013's Man of Steel, and it's not said by Superman, it's actually said by a rather minor character, but it's a nice little reference to a character that is in Brian Azzarello and Jim Lee's Superman for Tomorrow, and the character's name is Father Leone. And the quote goes, "Sometimes you have to take a leap of faith first. The trust part comes later." Good night, folks.
Up, up, and away!
For more Up, Up, and Away, visit www.upupandaway.podomatic.com. The show and other Superman-related goodies can be found on Facebook by searching Up, Up, and Away Podcast, and Mario can be contacted through email at mbenesi94@yahoo.com. That's B as in boy, E-N-N-E-S-E. Up, Up, and Away is a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, and Superman and all related images are property of DC Comics and Warner Brothers Entertainment. All images and music are property of their respective owners, and no infringement is intended. This is a non-profit fan podcast. Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.